Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Dan Ehrle, the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University and author of Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. Professor Ehrle is a founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. He spends much of his time trying to figure out how to help us humans make better decisions and has a bi-weekly advice column in the Wall Street Journal. Professor Ehrle is the author of numerous books, three of which are New York Times bestsellers: Predictably Irrational, The Upside of Irrationality, and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Along with a PhD in business administration from Duke, he holds a PhD in cognitive psychology from the University of North Carolina. He has over a dozen TED Talks and other videos online with tens of millions of views. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dan Ehrle.
Thanks for showing up. A guy comes to his mother. And he says, "Mother, after 40 years, I finally decided to get married." And the mother is so happy. And she said, "I would love to meet your future wife." And the guy said, "How about Friday night for dinner?" She said, "Great." And then he says, "You know, Mother, in the last 3 years, I dated three other women. Why don't I bring all four women to dinner? And let's see if you could guess which is the one I'm going to marry." The mother's excited, the guy's excited. Friday night dinner, he comes with all four women, and the mother starts interrogating them. She's talking to the first, the second, the third, the fourth. She goes back and forth for an hour. At the end of the hour, she points to one of them and says, "This is the one. This is the one you're going to marry." And the guy is shocked. He says, "Mother, how well you know me. How well you understand." He said, "I love all of these women. I respect all of them. I care about all of them. I'm friends with all of them. But this is indeed the one. This is the one I'm going to spend the rest of my life with." And he said, "What gave it away? What was the hint, the characteristic, the attribute that made it clear to you that this is the one?" So the mother looks at him and she says, "It's the only one I hate." So we're here to talk about human nature. Some of the wonderful things about human nature and some of the less wonderful things. So I started writing this book, Payoff, about a year and a little bit ago. And I did it when I kind of was realizing that there were lots of things that I was doing that did not seem to maximize my happiness. And I was kind of wondering, why am I doing the things I'm doing? And in particular, because of my injury and because I wrote in a very explicit way about life in hospital, I get lots of people who write me with different injuries. So about twice a week, somebody writes me and they want to talk about their life after their injury. I mean, when people get injured, it's very easy to see all the things that they have lost. It's a little harder to see how can life be afterward. And I describe in the introductory chapter a very painful story that I actually tried to tell in front of an audience a few days ago, and I was just crying. So I'm going to spare you. I'm going to spare myself the challenge of whether I'm going to cry or not. So I will skip that. But I'll tell you another example. That story in the introduction for the book is a story about a kid who was burned, actually worse than I was, and I kind of got involved into his life. But anyway, a different story. Maybe 2 years ago, I get a very quick email from somebody asking me if I can call them up. And I called that person up. And it turns out that that person was a quadriplegic. They lost all movement from the neck down. And they wanted to talk about what can they do with their life moving forward. And I called him up and we talked. And I was trying to understand what kind of things make him happy and what kind of things he had skills to do, and we kind of made plans of what the kind of things he could try out. And he also asked me about what do I think about committing suicide. And I said, you know, I'm not against it in principle, but given that it's a one-way street, why don't we try other things first? And we made plans of trying a couple of different things. And I called him about once a week, and we would kind of try to figure out how much progress he's made, and as he figure out what can make him happy, and so on. And he wasn't really making a lot of progress. Every week was kind of a rehash of the previous week with very little progress. And we tried different approaches. And at the end of about 4 months later, he committed suicide. And I started wondering why did he give up? Why did he give up and other people did not? So I started talking with other people with different injuries and trying to kind of figure out what gets people to sustain and what gets people to give up. And there's much more to study and say about this. But one of the guys I talked to not too long ago is also a quadriplegic. And what was amazing to me when I talked to him is how he changed the focus of his life from being about some overall meaning to being about triumphing the daily struggle. So, for example, he decided that he wants to get dressed by himself. It's actually very hard to get dressed by yourself if you're a quadriplegic, but he puts his clothes down and he wiggles himself into the clothes and he has a stick to move the clothes, and he times himself and he measures his success by timing and small success, small triumphs. And it wasn't just that. His whole life is about a series of small conquers, trying to do small things. And I think there's a couple of things about it. One is it's about control. It's about gaining control and trying to figure out that we're not helpless, right? If you think about somebody who lets other people just dress him or do whatever other people can do more easily and more efficiently, it is about giving some control. And it's also about defining some goals that are very attainable. Not easy, but attainable. The other thing about this story and the other stories like this is that, you know, from my personal experience, when I talk to these guys, it is misery. Right? When we think about happiness, what is the thought that we have when we think about happiness? We think about somebody sitting on the beach drinking mojito. We're thinking about somebody watching, I don't know, some sitcom on TV. But if I look at my own life and I look at the way I choose to spend my own life, a lot of it doesn't fit with that model of happiness. Talking to somebody with a severe injury every week about what's going on, doing all kinds of things like that is incompatible with happiness. Right? It doesn't seem happiness. Or think about something else, marathon. When you look at people who run the marathon, they look like they're suffering. I mean, they are suffering. If you were an alien and you came to Earth and you saw a marathon, you would say, these people were punished. Somebody is punishing. This is what they're kind of paying the debt to society in some way. And it's true that nobody burst out laughing and nobody is smiling in a big way when they run the marathon. But nevertheless, it is something that gives people deep happiness. And I look at my own life and I look at all the things that I do that don't seem to bring me momentary joy, but nevertheless give, I think, a sense of meaning and accomplishment and contribution and so on. And my exploration really is about trying to figure out how do we change our mindset from kind of the right to pursue happiness and thinking about happiness as a momentary feeling that we might have of joy to something broader that might include the sense of purpose and meaning and accomplishment and competition and contribution to others. And I think that's really the question of what I'm trying to do with this research is to figure this out. Okay, so that's kind of on the big level. In terms of concrete terms, I want to tell you about one experiment that that we've conducted. So this was an experiment that we did with Intel, the chip manufacturer. And we did it in their production company, in their production factory. And, you know, one of the difficult things is to assess the productivity of probably everybody here in this room. If I watched over you for the whole day, it would be really hard for me to figure out are you having a productive day or a non-productive day. But people who make chips, we can actually, computer chips, we can actually count how many chips they make. So the measurement of productivity is higher. And if you think about it, this is kind of the proxy for motivation. How interested are people in producing and how much they can produce. So in this particular factory, the way things work is that people come for 4 days to work and then they have 4 days off. 4 days on, 4 days off. And on the days that they work very long shifts, 12-hour shifts. So 12 hours, day one, day two, day three, day four, 4 days off, and back to the first day. And the incentive structure that Intel created was that on the first day of this work cycle, they said, look, we're worried that people came out of 4 days off, that they're not kind of coming on in a full-blown way, so let's give them a target for how much we want them to produce on the first day, let's say 1,300 chips, and let's give them a bonus of $30 if they reach it. So the general process was that you came back after 4 days off, and they would say, if you achieve this level of 1,300 computer chips, we will give you $30. If you don't, you'll get zero. And then the second day, there's no target and no bonus. The third day, no target and no bonus. The fourth day, no target and no bonus. 4 days off and back to the first day. That's the system that they have been running for a while. So we came to them and we said, look, this is really interesting. Can we add a control condition? What's a control condition? A control condition is a condition in which you do nothing and you just compare how those two systems work. And they agreed. So we agreed on the control condition. And then we said, what about the third condition in which instead of giving people money, we'll send them pizza at home? We said this way, what they're getting is not financial, but it's a gift. Plus, it would make them heroes in the eyes of their families. Lots of discussions about pizza at home. Eventually, it turns out that that's too complex for the HR department of Intel. Anybody here works for Intel? One, two? Okay. We can talk later about your opinion about the HR department. Or maybe you work for the HR department. No. Okay, there's a big no. Yeah, okay. Okay, so we had nothing, pizza, and text. And then we say, what about the fourth condition in which people will get a text message from the boss saying, nice job? And they agreed. So here's what happened. People came on the first day of the shift. A quarter of the people were told nothing. A quarter of the people were told, if you produce 1,300 chips, you'll get $25. A quarter of the people were told, if you produce at this level 1,300 chips, you'll get a voucher for pizza, right? Pizza was too complex. The voucher for pizza was okay. And a quarter of the people were told, if you produce at this level 1,300 chips, you'll get a nice text message from the boss. Okay, now think about this. Now we have that day. Which group do you think performed the best? So let's get the vote so we get to see. And in this vote, everybody has to vote. You can't stay at home. Okay, how many people vote for the control condition was being the best? Okay, maybe 10 people. How many of you think that the money condition did the best? Okay, maybe 25. How many people think the pizza condition did the best? Okay, many more. How many people think the compliment condition did the best? Okay, that's the majority. Okay, so it's a slightly trick question because you're both right and wrong. So here's what happened. On that first day of the shift, for fun, let's call it Monday, the control condition did the worst, and all three other conditions were basically the same. Money was slightly worse than the other two, but they were all basically the same. So when the incentive was on, people were working harder. When there was no incentive, people were working less. But the question is, what happened the next day? Remember, the next day there was no target, there was no bonus, there was no incentive. But is there any residue from the previous day? There was. What happened? The money condition went up on the first day by about 5%. It went down by 12% the next day. It's as if people said, yesterday you paid me, I was interested in working. Today you're not paying me, I'm just not that interested. Right? And they worked less than they did in a control condition. It went slightly up on the third day, almost caught up to the control condition on the fourth day. And in total, by giving people a $30 bonus, Intel lost 5% of productivity across the whole week. Now, it's a lot. 5% is a lot, right? And they paid people to lose productivity. So we went to talk to the top management in Intel, and we said, hey, you know, you had a theory of something that you thought would increase human motivation. Increase the employee motivation. It's not only did not increase it, it decreased it. We said, maybe you should doubt your understanding of motivation more generally and your intuition about motivation. Maybe you're also wrong in how you give bonuses to the top management. I said, why don't you let us review all the bonuses for top management and we could... and we might be able to recommend some changes. How excited do you think they were? Yeah. No interest whatsoever. No interest whatsoever. Okay, so that was the money condition. What happened in the compliment condition, the text message? It went up slightly more than the money on the first day and slowly went down over the next few days. It didn't cost them anything, and it actually increased productivity compared to the control condition. And what happened to the pizza? It was kind of between. It went up, like the compliment condition, went slightly below the control... it went up like the compliment condition, went down slightly below the control condition, and basically kept up between the two. And I suspect that if the pizza was more kind of real pizza with crust and you know, a smell, it would have been even better than the compliment condition. And if it would have been more transactional-like, it would have been worse than just like the money condition. Now, this whole research falls into what we call social norms and market norms. And the idea is that we function out of two very different motivations that don't add up. So, for example, imagine you're a 25-year-old guy, you're going on a date, and you paid for dinner and a drink, and you walk up with your date to her apartment, and you're kind of hoping for a good night passionate kiss, and you're walking up the stairs to her apartment, and just before you lean to try and kiss her, you say, interestingly, I spent $125 on the date so far. How good will the date turn out? There are some experiments we don't need to run. This is probably one of them. But if you think about it, why is it not going to work out well? Because when we date somebody, it's not always going to work out, but we have this sense that we're trying to figure out if it's going to work out for the long term, right? Are we compatible or not? And we'll work it out. We'll try and figure it out. But the moment you say, I spend $125 on a date so far, you're just saying we're in a tit-for-tat relationship, right? It's not about long term. This was my turn. Now it's yours. And it's really about kind of reciprocity in the short term in a very particular way. You're not revealing anything that people don't know. We know what's the price on the menu. We know who paid for it. We know what's the price of a drink. But by saying something, stating it in that regard, you're changing the relationship to be very transactional. And that's actually what Intel did as well, right? What they did was they said, here is what we want. We just care about your productivity on this day at this level, and this is what we want from you. And when you give people the money, they work hard. But the moment money is gone, motivation is gone as well. You see, in general, in the world, we rely a lot on goodwill. If you think of any job out there, we rely a lot on goodwill. You know, some jobs a little bit less, some jobs a bit more. As a university professor, the university relies on my goodwill to a very large degree. I have tenure, right? In principle, they can't fire me, which means that my whole decision of how hard to work is just up to me. And as we move into the knowledge economy more and more, we're more and more in a world in which we rely on people's goodwill. And the question is, what gets people to have goodwill? And the answer is that money is not always the right recipe. And in fact, paying people for something explicit is a recipe for killing motivation rather than hurting it. Here's another example. Imagine I invite you for dinner and you were going to spend $35 on a bottle of wine. And you come to my house, but you don't know what wine I like, red, white, California, European. So you come to my house and you say, thank you very much for inviting me for dinner. I really appreciate it. I was going to spend $35 on a bottle of wine, but not knowing what wine you like and what you don't like, I don't want to waste money. So here is $33. Go ahead and buy yourself the best possible wine that you like the most. And it's certainly more financially efficient. But will it contribute to our friendship? If you had some, you wanted some advice the next week, you wanted some help in something, would I help you in any way? The answer is absolutely not. I will charge you, right? We will find out some exchange rate. So the point is that we have a notion of what motivates people. And the notion of motivation is often this very simplistic idea of motivation equals money. But the fact is that money is not always the best way to motivate us, and sometimes it's actually something that demotivates us. And maybe the saddest example in recent history in the U.S. is the No Child Left Behind policy. Think about what we did. We took teachers who chose this profession not because they thought this was the easiest way to get rich, but because they had a mission and a commitment and a belief in education. And at some point, we came up with something called the No Child Left Behind policy, which basically told teachers that we don't care about their judgment. We don't want to give them autonomy. Instead, we want to measure everything. And we have a test, and all we care about is the performance on the kids on the test. And we care about nothing else. And they could get $400 extra if their kids performed well on this particular test. And what happened? We actually decreased motivation. Right? Teachers basically started caring less and less and less. There's all kinds of other negative events. So there's lots of cases like this that we, instead of adding to motivation, we actually take it away. There are many more other stories and approaches on motivation, but I am told here that my time for the initial discussion is up. So I'm happy to take comments, questions, concerns.
Since you've done so much research on dishonesty, I was wondering if you had any comments on the election process that we just went through and the results.
Dishonesty and the election, what?
It's shocking. Shocking. You know?
So let me say maybe two things about this. The first one is, yes, this election season was kind of shocking in terms of the extent of dishonesty. And people did not seem to be outraged. And we were wondering, how come people are not outraged by the dishonesty? So we did some studies on this, and we found that people wanted their politicians to be dishonest.
No.
Now, why is that? There's a little story in the Bible that God comes to Sarah. And he says, Sarah, you're going to have a son. And Sarah laughs. And she says, how can I have a son when my husband is so old? God says, don't worry, you'll have a son. And then God goes to Abraham. And he says, Abraham, you're going to have a son. And Abraham says, did you tell Sarah? And God says, yes. And Abraham says, and what did Sarah say? And God said, Sarah said, how could she have a son when she is old? So God lies. And the religious scholars wondered, how could God lie? And their conclusion, it's okay to lie for peace at home. Now, if you think about this, this is really the essence of dishonesty. It turns out that we have many human values. Honesty is one of them, but not all human values are compatible all the time. What happens when some human values are incompatible? Right? How do I make you feel? Honesty. Which one wins? And the idea that we care more about peace and home basically means that sometimes honesty should give up to other things. And that's what we found is happening, happened a lot in this election. This election was very ideological on both sides. People on the left care about environmental policies. People on the right want to abolish Obamacare. Whatever the ideology is, people cared a lot about the ideology and were willing to sacrifice dishonesty on the way there. So it's not that people wanted dishonesty for dishonesty's sake, but what happened was that people cared about the policies so much that they wanted their politician to sacrifice honesty. By the way, people wanted the politicians on the other side of the aisle to be honest, right? Because we care about honesty. But for our politicians, we care more about the policy than honesty, so we want them to sacrifice. And in fact, we want them to sacrifice because we think this way they would be able to more likely convince the idiots on the other side that this is a good thing. And it happened, and by the way, one of the challenges, of course, is that when you start a process where dishonesty is becoming acceptable, it is a slippery slope. So it's a very worrisome thought, because ask yourself, where are we going to be in the next election? What's going to be the standard, the acceptable standard of honesty in 4 years from now? Are we going to go to a high standard, or are we going to start from where we are now? Most likely we're going to start from where we are now. Another experiment I want to tell you about that I think is important to think about. So when we do experiments on dishonesty, one of the methods we use is with a die, with a six-sided die. So we give people a die and we say, why don't you roll this die, and we'll pay you based on whatever it comes up on. It comes on one, we'll give you $1, two, two, three, three, and so on, up to six. But you can get paid based on the top side or the bottom. Top or bottom, you decide, but don't tell us. So imagine you're in the experiment, you decide yourself top or bottom, you have it, you know what you want. Now you roll the die, and let's say it came up with five on the bottom and two on the top. And then I say, what did you pick? If you picked bottom, no problem. You say bottom, you get $5. If you pick top, you have a dilemma. Do you say the truth, top, and get $2? Or do you say bottom and get $5? And we get people to do this 20 times. And every time they think to themselves, top or bottom, they commit it to memory, they roll the die, they write down what the die came up with, and then they tell us what they chose. And when people do this 20 times, we find that people are incredibly lucky. And not only are people lucky, luck has this really nice feature on focusing on the 6-1 die tosses. That's the one that people are extra lucky. Okay, so that's kind of the general experiment, and we find that lots of people cheat a little bit. But this experiment I want to tell you about now is an experiment in which people came to the lab, and we said, look, we have this game, and we have two versions of it. In one version of the game, the exchange rate between dots and money is such that at most you can expect to make $4 today. There's another version of the experiment in which the exchange rate is such that at most you can make $40 today. So two experiments are identical, but one you can make $4, one you can make $40. And we say, why don't you toss a coin and we'll see which one you got, the $4 version or the $40 version. So people toss a coin, and no matter what they toss, we say, oh, sorry, you got the $4 version. But then the research assistant looks around, making sure that nobody's around. He says, psst. He said, listen, my boss is not here today. So I'll tell you what. You got $3 to show up for the experiment. If you will give me those $3, I will pretend you got the other coin flip. So he's basically asking for a bribe, right? What percentage of the students in our experiments, this was, I teach at Duke, these were Duke students, but they're not different from other people before you start making fun. What percentage of our students do you think bribed the experimenter? So let's just get a little vote. How many people think it's around 10% of the students? Around 10%, maybe 12 people. How many people think it's between 0 and 25? By the way, if you raise your hand for 10, you should also raise your hand for between 0 and 25. This is Silicon Valley, after all. Okay. So between 0 and 25? Okay, maybe a quarter. Between 25 and 50? Okay, more people. Between 50 and 75? Okay, a few people. Above 75? Oh, wow, surprising. Okay, above 85? Above 90? Okay. Okay, so it is 90%. Now, just to be clear, we've been running experiments around the world. People never come to us and ask to bribe us, right? We run with suitcases, with cash, we're running experiments. People don't show up and say, hey, can I bribe you? So this was not an experiment in which the students bribed us. This was an experiment in which we asked for a bribe, and they bribed us. And what happened... And almost everybody bribed us, right? 90%. And what happened after the student bribed us and we moved them from the $4 version to the $40 version? They're going to make much more money. Did they cheat more, less, or the same? They cheated more. They cheated more, and not only did they cheat more, they started stealing. So what do I mean by stealing? So I told you that they have this sheet of paper that they write. The die came out on 5 and 2, and I chose 5. It came on 6 and 1, I chose 1. It came on 3 and 4, I chose 3. I mean, people make this list. And at the end, they have a little equation, and they say, given all the dots that I guessed, here's how much money you owe me. And let's say it's $23. And once they finish writing $23 and they circle that number, we come to them with the envelope with $50. And we say, here's an envelope with $50. Why don't you pay yourself the amount of money you deserve? The amount of money you don't deserve, leave in the envelope. And as you leave the room, there's a big box with envelopes. Drop it there. So now you have two chances of being dishonest. You can say, oh, I really thought top, I really thought bottom. But you can also write $23 and take $24 or $25 or even $50. And in general, we find that people cheat but don't steal. We find that people are extra lucky on the die toss, but once they write $23, they take $23. And this, by the way, is also true for crooks. And we've been running this experiment outside of the parole office in downtown Durham, waiting for people to come out of parole. They, too, cheat and don't steal. But this corruption experiment I told you about was the first time that people stole. So here's the thing, right? What happens when we get good people to join a system where the person running the system is telling the system is corrupt? Just like that, people switch, right? Our students cheat a little bit here and there, yes, but generally they're honest. The moment they came to a system where the person running the system said that something is wrong, something is corrupt, basically changed dramatically their approach to honesty and to stealing. And I think that's a very worrisome thought, because it means that once we have a system that we think is corrupt, it basically licenses people to behave in all kinds of terrible ways, and it's very hard to change that. So, and you can think about it as corruption as one thing, but you can think about it all kinds of things that society basically is all of a sudden saying these are acceptable behaviors. And as society tells us, that our new behaviors that we did not know are acceptable and now acceptable, how quickly are we going to change? So anyway, I'm a little depressed.
Do you think telling the electorate that the system is rigged and that there's rampant voter fraud created voter fraud?
I think it certainly helps. I think that if we know that other people are misbehaving, it's very likely to misbehave as well. And our ability to kind of justify bad behavior is really incredible. So I'll tell you, you know, these experiments are a little depressing. I'll tell you about a little happier experiment. But so I own a vending machine. not as a business, but as an experimental approach. And in this particular experiment, we wrote on the candy machine, say, 75 cents per candy. And there were all kinds of candies. But the inside of the machine, we set it to said zero. So what happened is you put your money, whatever you put in, and the machine gave you all your money back because everything was more than zero. And it gave you the candy. So you put your money in, you press the button, you got all your money and the candy. And there was a big sign that says, if something is wrong with the machine, please call this number. So question number one in human psychology, what percentage of people called? Zero, absolutely. And how many candies did people take? No. The majority took either three or four. Nobody took five. Why? Because taking five would be stealing. And the idea is that people could justify it, right? So people could say something like, I remember this other vending machine that took my money and didn't give me a candy. And that other vending machine is clearly a close relative of this one. And I'm just balancing my vending karma. But the other thing that people did was to call friends to participate as well. Because if other people behave this well, it's clearly more okay. So if you think about what we find acceptable and not acceptable, it really doesn't come from what's legal and not legal. It comes from what other people are doing and not doing. This, given that this is California, how many of you have on your computers illegal music or movies or some other documents? Okay, lots of people. And I guess the gentleman sitting here, you just don't know how to do it. It's not...
he wants to. He doesn't know how.
It's not a moral issue. But, you know, we know it's illegal, right? I asked you about illegal downloads. Like, there's no question. So I didn't know it was illegal. No, we know it's illegal, but we don't care. And the reason we don't care is we decide as society that this is fine. That for some reason it's okay to take other people's property, people that we like and appreciate, and not pay them what they want us to pay them, right? We somehow agree that this is morally okay. And this idea of what is socially acceptable is incredibly important, and it can deteriorate very quickly. And again, this is a worrisome point in this potential transition.
Anything else on irrationality with politics and the election?
There's a lot of things. Let's move on to some.
Okay. Stuff that's more tech relevant. So you discuss the problem in a tech company and how canceled projects, you know, motivates the thinking of those people. You know, that is very common here in Silicon Valley. So how do you get those people motivated again now that, you know, you're sort of cleaning up after bad decisions and that leaders made and how those people were treated? How do you kind of get them back on track?
Yeah. So there was a discussion I described in which I came to a big software company in Seattle. And this company took a group of 200 engineers and took them outside of the regular campus. They said that there's not really much innovation in the regular campus, and they wanted to put this group in a different place, hoping they would innovate in coming up with something exciting. And I came to talk to this group, and it was like an unbelievably depressed group of people. It was just incredible. And I described to them this experiment that we did with Legos. I didn't really know that they were depressed. It was clearly depressed, but I described to them this experiment. And here's the experiment. People come to the lab, and we give them Lego Bionicles. And we say, would you like to build one for $3? And if they say yes, they start building it. And when they finish, we take it away from them, we put it under the table, and we say, would you like to build another one for $270? They say, yes, we give them the next one for $270, and they get diminishing pay rate until they said enough. That was one condition, the one we called meaningful condition. We had another condition we called the Sisyphic condition, in which we gave them the first one, they built it. We said, do you want another one? If they said yes, we gave them another one, but we kept the first one on the table. And as they were building the second one, we were taking the first one apart and putting the pieces back into the box. And if they finished the second one, we asked, would you like to build a third one? If they wanted, we gave them the first one back. So if you remember the story of Sisyphus, Sisyphus was punished by the gods to push a rock up the hill, and as he was almost getting there, the rock would go all the way down and he would have to do it over and over and over. And you could imagine how if it was different hills, right? If there were like a million hills and he would at least get some sense of progress, it wouldn't be as demeaning and demoralizing. But the fact was the same thing over and over and over. Anyway, what did we find? We find that, first of all, people stopped much faster, right? In principle, people were there to work for money. But when we took people and destroyed their labor in front of their eyes, it demoralized them and they stopped much faster. By the way, everybody knew we were going to destroy the Legos in the end of the session for the next participant, right? It wasn't that people had the illusion that their Bionicle would appear in the MoMA somewhere or, you know, live in some, I don't know, piece of art somewhere. But just destroying in front of their eyes rather than at the end made a difference. The second thing that happened was we measured how much people love Legos, right? Some people love Legos, some people don't. And you would expect that people who would love Lego would persist longer for less pay because they get more internal joy from it. And the people who don't like Lego wouldn't persist. And that's actually what we saw in the regular condition. People who love Legos worked hard, worked longer for less money. People who didn't like Lego stopped faster. In the Sisyphic condition, that correlation was zero. We basically, by destroying things in front of people's eyes, we were able to suck the joy out of their activity. We took the people who would otherwise enjoy Lego and made them not enjoy that process. The third thing we found out is we went to a business school in Palo Alto. So we went to the Stanford to the business school, and we tried to see whether the MBA students, what would they predict will happen in terms of the difference in productivity, right? So we say, hey, you have these two factories. How much productivity do you expect here? How much do you expect here? And they predicted it correctly. They kind of predicted that in the meaningful condition, people would build more Bionicles than in the not one, but they dramatically underestimated the effect. Right, they thought the effect would be tiny when in fact it was very large. Now going back to this company to be remain nameless in Seattle, when I described this experiment to these people, they basically said that they just experienced that exact experiment. They said, we were just there. What happened was that they were working for 2 years on this project, and a week before I came, the CEO came to visit and decided to cancel that project. And they were completely demotivated. And I asked them, I said, how many of you now show up later to work? Everybody show up later. I said, how many of you go home earlier? How many of you work, you know, don't do as much? They all do. I asked them, how many of you now kind of pad your expense reports? Nobody raised their hand, but they took me to dinner. They showed me what you could do with an expense report. expense account. And then I asked them the question that you asked me. I said, look, let's assume that the CEO had to cancel that. You know, we could say let's not cancel, but let's say they had to cancel it. How could the CEO have canceled the project but not demotivate you to that degree? And they had all kinds of ideas. They said, what if we asked them to figure out which parts of the technology that they were developing could fit in other parts of the organization? They said, what if they allow them to create a few working prototypes and let them run in the company for a few years and revisit this in a couple of years? They said, what would happen if he asked them to present to the whole company their journey over the 2 years, what they learned, what are the lessons, what they tried that didn't work out, so that they at least disseminate some of it. And if you think about all of those suggestions, they all require time, attention, and effort. But the CEO did not understand the role of meaning. So he said, look, I told you to run in this direction, to work on this, and now I say stop this and start something else. And he did not think about the intrinsic motivation of the people who were working for him. So if he did not, why would he invest effort in maintaining their motivation? By the way, the really sad outcome of this was that a few weeks later, most of the good people in that group left, right? And they did not leave because they left because they were just disappointed. They were feeling betrayed, right? And I'm not sure actually what would have been worse, for them to leave or to stay disenchanted within the company. But the way we cancel things, delayed point, you know, it just has to happen from time to time. If we don't worry about the motivation of people who've kind of, their effort has been kind of shattered. You know, just imagine that you were writing something or doing a podcast, or and you knew that, oh, creating a PowerPoint presentation, and you knew that nobody would ever look, listen, or see what you're doing. How exciting would that be? It would be awful. And then let's say you worked on something and you thought some people would see it and they canceled, and then they gave you another task. How likely are you to not think that this one too might get canceled? Right? So the question of how do we, at breakpoints, treat people in a way that will not demotivate them for the future is incredibly important, and we need to invest in it. Otherwise, we'll suffer the consequences.
What about keeping people motivated for long periods of time if they're working on a really extended project? How do you sort of keep up their energy and motivation throughout? Do you break it into pieces and give them milestones along the way, or what do you do? What do you suggest?
Yeah. So first of all, I think we need to understand that real motivation comes from a long-term perspective, right? Think about something like a romantic relationship. Imagine that you decided to have a relationship with your significant other that was on a day-by-day basis. That every day you wake up, you look lovingly into their eyes, and you say, what do you say? Shall we do this for another day or end it here? And you do this. You do this every day. How much would you invest in that relationship? Right? I'm not saying would you get divorced quicker, but how much would you invest? Not so much, right? But by the fact that we say we're here for a long time, and we know that doesn't always work, but the fact that we say this would work for a long time, we change our perspective from being on day-by-day basis to something long-term, and we're willing to suffer ups and downs and have a very different relationship with each other. So having a long-term view is incredibly important. It's incredibly important for motivation. At the same time, being motivated about something that will happen 4 years from now is good as a mindset, but it's very hard to get out of bed with a motivation that is just about the long-term goal. And because of that, we need to think about small accomplishments along the way. So if you think about the example I gave of the quadriplegic guy and how he's fighting small things, and everything is becoming a challenge and a target and a goal, that's actually incredibly important. So we need to figure out how to take, to have long-term view, but to break it into small accomplishments and be able to celebrate success, not just every year or 4 years.
So lots of questions from the audience around motivating kids, motivating students, how teachers can drive motivation, how to foster motivation in our schools, things like that. Any thoughts on that?
So, you know, one of the maybe most important questions in motivation is whether we reward process or whether we reward the outcome. So imagine two kids. One of them studied really hard, went to the exam, and got a C. The other one partied all night, didn't study at all, went to the exam, and got an A. It can happen, right? And I'm not saying that because they're different in skill, but one kid might have missed some of the material, and one kid maybe knew the only thing that was on the exam. He knew one thing, and that was happened to be on the exam. It can happen. Which of those kids do you want to reward? Now, of course, we want to reward the kid who studied hard. Because if we reward the kid who didn't study hard, what are we telling them? We're saying, not studying hard is perfectly fine. Right? But in real life, what we hope that kids would learn is that studying is the stochastic process that would lead to success. Not all the time, but in many times. But if you study hard, that will be very good for you. Versus if we just focus on the outcome, it's not as predictable. What should you do? So, and this, by the way, is also true in business. Just as an example, imagine that somebody does fantastic research. They look at all the variables and so on and decide to open a restaurant in the Gulf of Mexico 2 weeks before BP decides to spill some oil in the same place. Has this guy made a bad decision or a good decision? Well, the outcome, who could have known? Right? So you don't want to punish them based on the action of BP. You want to basically reward good systematic thinking process. Now, the problem is it's a lot of time, it's really hard for us to measure what went into a decision. So we reward people based on the outcome, assuming that the outcome is correlated. But as the correlation between outcome and process are weaker and weaker, it's a worse and worse decision to reward the outcome. So particularly with kids, you know, we kind of know how well they're studying and what they're doing and so on. It's very important to reward the process rather than the outcome. And it's very important to get them to enjoy the process rather than enjoy the outcome. If you get a kid who enjoys studying, it's a much better thing than if you have a kid who enjoys getting A's. It is a recipe for life. So I think that's one of the most important.
Mm-hmm. Several questions from the audience around the best compensation models that you've seen. If money doesn't motivate people or has a negative reaction in the end, what does create the best motivation and compensation structure?
Yeah, so it's very hard to say in general what is the best compensation structure, but let me give you two case studies and then we'll think about what it means. So we did a project at the call center of a big hotel chain. And call centers, again, are good places where we can quantify people's productivity. How many customers they deal with, how many customers are happy, what they sell, and so on. And this company was giving bonuses that are about up of a third of people's salary were bonuses. And they were giving bonuses to the top employees. And they gave us the data, and we saw that it was always the same people who were getting the bonuses. Now, if you saw this data, what would you suspect? Why is it the same people who are getting the bonuses? And you could suspect all kinds of things. You can say, well, maybe it's nepotism. You can say, maybe some people have better shifts than others. You could say, maybe these are the people who are good at their jobs. You can have all kinds of theories. So we asked this company to let us decide who gets the bonuses. Now, they were a little afraid of this. So we send a couple of students to their office, and the students who look good in a suit, and they presented to all the employees, and they said, our name is CAH, it stands for the Center for Advanced Hindsight, which is my research center, but we didn't give them the full name. We said, we, as an outside entity, will determine your bonuses for the next 6 months. It's not the company. So now they were not going to blame the company for this. And what happened is every Friday we would get the data, we would run our algorithms, and we will decide who gets bonuses and how much. And what kind of bonuses do you think, what kind of algorithms do you think we tried? Random, exactly. Why? Because if you have a particular theory, for example, that the best employees should get the bonuses, you never know what would have happened if you did something else. But if you do random, you could do all kinds of comparison. So we did random bonuses for 6 months. Of course, we didn't tell people those were randoms, right? That was not part of the plan. So people got random bonuses and lots of analysis we could do. But one of the analysis was to ask, when is the company better off? When they give bonuses to the top employees, the top half, or the bottom half? So what do you think? It's the bottom half. Why? Because it turns out that some people know what they're doing. There are some people who are good at the call center. Like, imagine you're a good singer. You just know how to sing. And now I pay you a little bit less. Are you going to start singing out of key? Right? If that's what you're comfortable with, and that's what you know, and that's what comes easy to you, that's what you do. It turns out there are people who are really good on the phone. They like what they're doing. They're enjoying it. They're good. You're paying them a bit more, a bit less. They don't start working less. Like, they might want to work harder, but they're at the top of their game. There's nothing more they can do. By the way, think about for most of you, if somebody paid you a bit more, what would you do differently? Like, if I think about my own life, you know, I already hardly sleep. I already have a lot of coffee. Like, what would happen if somebody said, do a little bit better? Like, what could I do? Could I convince my brain to think a little faster? I completely unclear what it would be. But the people who were the bottom employees, they could motivate themselves, right? Those are people who could actually have a room for improvement. By the way, our conclusion to this company was not to start paying the top employee less, right? The conclusion was to say you have some people who are top performers. Don't put them on this bonus system. The bonus system is just stressful, right? Just pay them a higher amount and give them a different title and put them in a different place. And now take the bonuses and use it for the people that can be moved up, that have some discretionary effort that they can put that would translate into improvement. One more story. I was invited by a foreign government to come and talk to the Ministry of Finance and Ministry of Education about compensating teachers. And what this Ministry of Finance wanted to do was to take the top 10% of good teachers in every school and give them a bonus. That was their idea. Let's take the top 10% and give them a bonus. And my first question to them was, what is your theory? Why would this help? Why would this help? And what they eventually articulated was that they think that teachers know what's the right thing to do, but they're too lazy, right? Not sufficiently motivated, but they know what's the right thing to do, but they're not doing it. And if there was a bonus, they would do it. And also that almost all of them can think that they'll be in the top 10%, right? Because if the bottom 90% don't think they could be in the top 10%, it will not motivate it. So they had a theory of people know what, teachers know what they need to do, they're just not that interested, they need a financial incentive, and almost everybody think they can get to the top. You know, one of the best things ever to, not in a theory, but empirically, one of the best ways to increase quality of education is to give the top teachers time to teach the not so good teachers. Why? Because most teachers don't teach as well, not because they don't want to, and not because they're lazy, they just don't know how. Teaching is actually a very complex profession. Think about it. You teach people and you hope that something will come out for them in 10 years from now. How often do you know that that's the case? Right? Really hard to figure out what works, what doesn't work. We don't get a chance to try lots of different things. Some people have figured it out. Take the people who figure it out, give them time to teach the people who haven't figured out. By the way, if that Ministry of Finance got their way, what would it ensure? That none of the good teachers would ever help anybody else. Because now they would come to a situation where they would try to protect their bonuses rather than help anybody. So what's the point? The point is that when we think about motivation, we can't just think about just money. You know, money is kind of a big hammer that you can think about applying. But what we really need to figure out is what's holding people back, right? Is something holding them back? Maybe nothing is holding them back. And you can say maybe what's holding people back is laziness, in which case money might be the right approach. Maybe you could say it's knowledge, right? People just don't know what to do, in which case money is irrelevant. Maybe you say what's holding people back is they don't see the outcome of their labor, in which case it's not money, it's some kind of connection to what they're doing. Whatever it is, what we need is a deeper analysis of what is going wrong, where are the weak points, where are we losing human motivation, and only after we do that, we can think about what's the right compensation. Is it about investing in people's education? Is it helping them out in creating social relationship, money, whatever it is? But we have to first analyze what is holding people back.
This is our last question from the audience. In terms of human behavior and motivation, what do you still want to research? What are you still curious about?
So I started by telling you about resilience, and I'm still trying to try and understand resilience. I think it's incredibly important. So that will be the first thing, that I just want to understand what is resilience, and not just what is it in terms of an individual personality trait, but what can we do to help? You know, we'll all encounter at some point of our lives, some difficult situations, some projects that are not going to work the way we want, some injuries, some illness, and so on. What can we do to help in those cases? That's the first thing. And then the other thing, there's this notion of what's called social utility. And social utility is about our ability to care about other people. So giving money to charity, helping people cross the street, giving people advice, whatever it is. Social utility is our ability to look at another person and get some satisfaction from them doing a little bit better, right? It's kind of it's basically altruism, and I really want to try and understand a bit more how does it work? To what extent is our motivation? What is the range of our motivation that are influenced by social utility? What is the role? If you think about it, it's amazing. Like what do we do in terms of giving and helping and so on? How do we think about social utility in terms of our daily lives? And I'll just give you two examples from studies by Mike Norton and Elizabeth Dunn that I like a lot. So in one study, they came to people, and half of them, they gave them a Starbucks gift card. And these people went in and bought themselves a cappuccino, and they called them in the evening, and they said, "How happy are you?" And they were just as happy as if they never got that cappuccino. Lesson number one, getting a cappuccino in the morning is not a guarantee to make you happier in the evening. The second group of people, they gave them the same gift card, but they asked them, please buy a stranger a cappuccino. They gave that gift card to somebody else. They called them in the evening. Those people were happier. Now, by the way, they didn't give them a cappuccino, right? It's like people took credit as if they gave them a cappuccino. No, they got the money from somebody else, and they just decided who to give it to. But still, you know, we're really good in taking too much credit. But now, if you got a Starbucks gift card right now, what would be your first instinct? Let me give it to somebody else? No. Your instinct would be, let me buy myself a cappuccino, because you have the momentary spike in happiness that comes from drinking coffee, but you don't understand that long term you might be happier by giving things to other people. And then an even more interesting experiment, they did this experiment on pharmaceutical representative in Belgium, and they took groups of them, and some people got 15 euros to spend on themselves. And they said after the company gave them 15 euros to spend on themselves, how much harder did they work? And they worked slightly harder, and for every 15 euros, the company got less than 5 back. People worked slightly harder. Another group of people got 15 euros to spend on somebody else in their team, buy them a gift. Now for every 15 euros, the company got 80 euros back in terms of increased productivity. This idea of social utility, of our ability to care about others, how much happiness it gives us, how does it function as a social lubricant, what is its role, what do we think about the social structure within organization, what is the role of friendship and caring and so on, I think is an incredibly important topic. So that'll be my number two.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I hope everyone has enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, I'd like to thank Dr. Dan Ehrle, author of Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you who are joining us online and on the web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.